itself is an incredibly staunch democratic stronghold and beyond progressive and anarchist. And this is all because of the mining history. The labor unions became very, very strong. Butte had some of the first actual unions. There are whole books written about it and all, and that has carried through. And so Butte's very proud of its progressive standpoint. I did a show a while ago. Each of my radio shows has a very specific theme, and it might be Arabic women singers or African guitar or blues covers or something kind of specific. Anyway, I did one that was political, and of course it all leaned in one direction. And I got a couple of messages from people who listen from afar, and they were like, "Are you still alive? Is it okay that you played all that?" And I was like, "This is Butte." They buy me drinks when I do these kinds of shows.
This time on the Plutopia podcast, Suzanne Stefanik joins us from Butte, Montana. We talk about her work on low-power FM radio, COVID and conservatives, the current state of journalism and education, and a new mantra, be good, do good.
Here we are with another episode of the Plutopia podcast, and our guest today is Suzanne Stefanik, also known as Zorka. She's an interactive media consultant. She used to be a journalist. As a journalist, she wrote about digital issues for Wired, Macworld, New York Times, and Rolling Stone, among others. And when MSNBC launched in 1996, wow, has it been that long? She was executive producer for The Site, an hour-long nightly television program and website that explored how technology impacts or screws up modern life. And lately, she's been hosting Radio Free Zorka in Butte, Montana on KBMF Radio 102.5. Hello. How are you doing?
Doing great, given the crazy times we live in.
Indeed. But we're really impressed that you're hosting Radio Free Zorka, because we do Radio Free Plutopia. We do kind of the same thing you do, except we do it on internet radio.
We do both. We have both terrestrial and a low-power terrestrial 100-watt. And then, of course, these days, streaming.
We were just saying that we wish we were ambitious enough to do terrestrial.
Well, it's an FCC thing, really. About 7 years ago, the FCC, for the first time in years, I guess, opened up pathways for filing to become a low-power station. And it was only open for a few weeks. And luckily for us, a young fellow who is quite radio savvy knew about this, and he liked Butte, and he wanted to start a radio station. And so here we are 7 years later.
You were involved with it from the beginning?
From the very beginning, yeah.
Yeah, you were fortunate to get the low-power FM license. The FCC pretty much bungled the whole rollout, and from what I heard from other friends in California and Alaska who run low-power FM, that just the process was just horrifying, and it was almost not worth doing.
Well, and yes, that's true. I mean, I think a number of people tried to do it, and you know, the criteria were esoteric and they didn't quite, you know, manage it. We were, again, just lucky that this guy, Clark Grant, who's only like in his early 30s now, but he has been a radio guy for years and had been general manager of a couple stations, so he understood the lingo, I think. And we were lucky, our community really supports it. You know, we had to buy some expensive equipment to get up and rolling, antenna and transmitter and all. And the community here is fantastic. They just are so supportive of the station.
So you're doing a weekly show there. Are you also involved in managing the station?
Well, so the way that that type of station launched, you have to have a 501c3 nonprofit as the actual FCC licensee. It's a lot of weird words, but you get the picture.
Yeah.
And so the Butte America Foundation was formed to do that, and I'm president of the board. And so we work in tandem very closely with the station. I mean, it's really one entity with two horns.
Yeah, Sandy Stone's doing a similar thing in Santa Cruz, KSQD.org. Oh. You know, so they have what they refer to as grassroots radio. It's a community radio station. Sounds like yours is similar to that.
I mean, one of the things that this opened up and that made it ideal for me personally was that there are very few freeform stations around anymore where the DJ can play whatever they want. And our station, we've trained over 140 DJs. And about 65, I think, right now are in regular weekly rotation because we're 24/7. And we do have a digital entity named Bob who fills in the wee hours. but in general, and so, you know, it made it easier.
We have a station in Austin called KOOP, Co-op Radio, which is a cooperative, structured as a cooperative. And they have a similar thing to that. They have a bunch of people trained, and they have, I think that they share the airwaves with a student radio station from the University of Texas, as I recall. So they don't have to do round-the-clock programming, but they do have a number of shows there that are quite popular in Austin.
You know, it's been interesting. I will say, I mean, I worked in print for so many years, and then the web and TV and radio was never really on my radar. So this has been an adventure, and I'm a lifelong music fanatic. And so this opportunity to, I haven't missed a show in the 6+ years.
Wow.
We have a sister station in South Africa, and we went and spent 5 weeks with them and things like that. I went to Standing Rock 3 times for some weeks at a stretch. And so during those times, I would pre-record the shows. It's not mandated, not all of the DJ, but they seem to love it so much that, you know, they sort of fight over slots. It's all very sweet, and it's created quite a community, and there's so many varieties of music. You know, people will tune in and they go, well, I turned it on and it just wasn't my métier. You know, it was classical or heavy metal or whatever, and that's not my thing. And you go, wait an hour, it'll be completely different. So
how did you... How did you come to have a sister station in South Africa?
So it's worth telling. So about 5 years ago, I guess, the station started getting these messages from a gentleman who said he was a Zulu prince and that he was looking for a radio station to partner with in the United States. And so, of course, everyone assumed this was a grand joke, either a joke or a scam or, you know, yeah, whatever. But after a week or so and doing a little research on the Zulu royal family, we realized that indeed Prince Sabo Zulu was, you know, telling the truth. And he had started this station called Nangoma FM. And it's largely young people. Our station is all over the map. We have high school kids and people in their 80s. So it's like full spectrum. But there are a couple of older folk, but it's mostly younger. And we had all sort of geared our mission statements around social justice and that sort of thing. And so there was a rapport. And Sabo came with 2 of his radio cohorts and spent 3 months here in Butte. And, you know, it got very family very quick. And then we got a grant from the Ford Foundation. And so 4 of us went to, as I mentioned, for the 5 weeks in KwaZulu-Natal, which is the state that is almost exclusively Zulu. And visited a lot of radio stations, as well as every historical and artistic and environmental and ecological sort of thing there was to see. They were incredible guides, and they've come back here a few times. And so, you know, here we were with a sister station on the exact other side of the earth.
Do you share programming with them?
We do. It's so a good deal of their programming is in their language, isiZulu. And so, of course, that wouldn't really work too well here. I know about a dozen words. But we do, for instance, there's been quite a lot of unrest in South Africa just recently. The President Zuma came under great fire, and there were a lot of issues. And we dealt with, when we were there, we learned a lot about the political situation. So we've been doing a series of interviews with one of the savviest of the young guys there, about exactly what's going on there, like very personal. And, you know, so many of us now, even ones who haven't gone to South Africa, kind of know this community somewhat. And so you can say, and Kokello said that, you know, something happened. And so there's a familiarity. And so there's a lot that that happens pretty regularly.
Well, you have a great location for a station. You're not, you know, near a mega metropolitan area, because I've talked to people that had tried to get a community station going in that environment, and it's almost impossible simply because of the resistance from the commercial broadcasters. You know, plus just having a frequency is it's like discovering gold or something if you have one. But how do you handle the financing for, you know, everyday expenses? From my days in radio with Pacifica Radio and KPFA and KPFT in Houston, it was always a struggle. We were all listener sponsored, so we had to really do a lot of pleading for money. How do you handle finances for your station?
Well, first of all, of course, trying to keep costs as low as we can, but it's still, you know, many tens of thousands of dollars a year, because we have 1.5 staff persons, and we're in a lovely old building. It's the Carpenters Union Hall. It's the oldest temple to labor in the Northwest, that sort of thing. But we, like all public, most public media, we do Pledge Week. And we do pretty well with that. It doesn't come near covering all of our expenses, but it does a decent job. We have a unique situation here in Butte where it was an old mining. I grew up here and then left for 40 some years. But when I came back, it wasn't so different, really. Very labor centric. It was a mining town. At the turn of the last century, it was incredibly wealthy, or at least a good number of the people were, and even the middle, there was a decent middle class and all, because the entire world was going electric and they needed copper, and we had the largest copper around. And so the thing about the Butte was that among the many cultural things that had grown up around this very vital and kind of busy world were parades. People loved them. And so the people who were running the parades here, and that's 4th of July, St. Patrick's Day is huge here, a big Irish population. People come from all over the country for it, a Halloween parade. And so we took over the parades. And they cost some money to put on, but the city of Butte is really kind of wonderful that way. We, our DJs carry buckets around and kind of solicit money during the parades. And the combo of the parade monies and the Pledge Week would just about cover it. We've been lucky. We've received some nice grants. Some grants are great, no matter what. I mean, it's just lovely to get them and all, but they require so much work, and they don't really allow you to use the money for institutional needs. You have to use it for very specific things that you've outlined in your grant, right? So, you know, like certain projects and stuff. So we're very grateful for the grants that are different than that. And we've received a couple of COVID ones that have been sizable and nice. And the Ford Foundation has been very generous with us. So it's a combo then of those three things, the pledge, the parades, and grants that allow us to spend money on things like salaries and rent and equipment and services and those things you just have to do every month or year.
I like the idea of the parade. I haven't heard of that. And that sounds like a great way to have, you know, funding coming in from the general public.
Become more aware of the station and have a very friendly feel for it. So,
looking at your broadcast schedule, I believe I saw that you were broadcasting one of the county commission or one of the
every Wednesday night. Yeah,
that is a great. We did the same thing at Pacifica Radio in Houston. We broadcast the city council meetings, which tended to upset the more conservative members of the council, but it was a great way to get the inner workings of the government out to the people. You didn't have to go to the meeting. You could tune in. I think that's a great thing you've done.
It's been great. You know, Butte is likes to think of itself as a very tough town. In fact, the most popular t-shirt says Butte Tough. So the meetings can be quite raucous, and it's entertaining in its own way. And, you know, it keeps people on their toes and helps to highlight issues that are being raised. And it's been a good thing to, and not incidentally, I mean, it helps the county courthouse where they're held is directly across the street from the station. So we could set up a link that worked.
So what's the political weather like in Butte?
So the state itself is quite right wing and right. But curiously, over time, there have been quite a few Democratic governors because Montana votes more for the person than the party, or at least has. Right now, we have an extreme right winger, Gianforte. And, you know, he's from New Jersey. It's weird to me that people even voted for him. You know, it's like curious. Butte itself is an incredibly staunch Democratic stronghold and beyond progressive and anarchist. And this is all because of the mining history. The labor unions became very, very strong. Butte had some of the first actual unions. There are whole books written about it and all, and that has carried through. And so Butte's very proud of its progressive standpoint. I did a show a while ago. Each of my radio shows has a very specific theme, and it might be Arabic women singers or African guitar or blues covers or something kind of specific. Anyway, I did one that was political, and of course it all leaned in one direction. And I got a couple of messages from people who listen from afar, and they were like, "Are you still alive? Is it okay that you played all that?" And I was like, "This is Butte." They buy me drinks when I do these kinds of shows. So we're in a unique situation here.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like Austin. You know, Austin is surrounded by Texas. We have a similar sense of being an oasis in a kind of desert. Though Texas is... it's not as red as it used to be. It may be purpling a little bit.
Well, that would be good to hear, because what we hear about Texas isn't very happy-making these days.
Well, it's been kind of tough for us right now. Somebody said I was being defensive about it, but I find myself pointing out that, you know, Texas and any state, really, any state that you can think of is not all one thing or not all a particular way. And the problem with Texas is that we are, well, for one thing, we're heavily gerrymandered. And we have a government that is very far to the right. It's been moving to the right, but it is not necessarily a reflection of the populace. And part of that is because they manipulate the votes. They They have still been able to win the statewide races, like for governor and the presidential race and that sort of thing, but not by so much, you know. But we do have a lot of Republicans in the House of Representatives, and those are the people who, like, were responsible for this abortion law that everybody's up in arms about now. But, you know, if there's a silver lining on that particular cloud, it's that it has people in Texas who were somewhat apathetic, pretty fired up right now. And, you know, other states like that might happen in Montana, too. I mean, it could happen anywhere.
Absolutely.
You take one step too far, you know, and you can get a backlash.
Well, I hope so. I mean, here, our governor has forbidden mask mandates. So that's crazy, you know.
And yeah, it's here too. Yeah.
I went to the grocery store yesterday and was very pleased to see that about 2/3 of the people were all wearing their masks, you know. But it's Butte. So statewide, that isn't necessarily as true. And so our numbers are starting to skew high again. And you just have to take a deep breath and enjoy what you can.
Well, you know, Saturday was the first football game of the University of Texas football season, and it was played here in Austin. And my wife likes to watch it. I'm not that much into football, but she is. But I noticed watching that thing that it was packed. The stadium was packed with people, and none of them were wearing masks. I don't think I saw a single person with a mask on. And that's kind of the way it is in Texas now. I had to take my computer to the mall to be repaired yesterday, and the mall was full of people, and probably, like, I'd say 70% of them were not masked.
It's a dilemma. I mean, I was just reading this morning about Sturgis and comparing it to Lollapalooza. And, you know, the numbers are pretty convincing, and yet so many remain unconvinced. It's you have hard numbers based on actual events and plenty of proof points. But, you know, as humans, logic is not always our friend, I guess.
It certainly isn't lately. That's for sure. There hadn't been a lot of logic lately. Do you miss journalism?
Well, you know, being as deeply embedded in this station as I am, I do a lot of behind the scenes interviewing and editing and, you know, kind of putting things up. It gets in your blood. You're right. I mean, I think it's hard to lose that urge to share, to try to be as fair as you can, while at the same time trying to go up against untruths and all. But I'm enjoying retirement. I wouldn't mind if I were had a little more free time, but I like doing it, and a lot of it's journalism, and so it kind of makes it all right.
Yeah, I tried to retire when I moved out here. I was in the Bay Area for 40 years working.
We must have been in the same room together a lot of times, I bet.
Could be. Yeah, I worked with Zodiac News Service, which was a alternative a radio news service, and so I went to all the things out there. But when I came to the Austin area, I thought I was going to retire. And that, I think I was just allergic to retirement, because I hooked up with John on Facebook. We grew up in the same little town. And here we are, just doing stuff. I left retirement in the dust a long time ago, and I don't really miss it. Of course, it'd be nice to have a few days off, but... Oops, sorry about that. Somebody's trying to sell me a warranty, I think, online.
Your car? Your warranty's up.
Oh, my Lord.
Either that, well, or Social Security. They're taking it away.
So what do you think about the state of journalism right now? Especially with, I guess, what we refer to as infotainment as being so paramount now, and news organizations struggling to figure out how to survive and make money. And this doesn't necessarily help the journalistic endeavor that much, because you know, you kind of have to use clickbait and other similar things to try to get enough traffic to have enough eyeballs that you can sell your advertising or whatever it is you have to do.
Well, I worry about a few things. one of them is that there is this segregation that happens, and that you have these echo chambers, which is particularly bad when what's being conveyed is false or misleading or conspiracy theory or whatever. And, you know, it's a function. We were there at the beginning of the whole digital revolution, and it was all shiny and new and pretty and cute. And it's still, you know, core to my existence, but it also gave rise with algorithmic, the machine making choices about what you'll see and all, and the fact that you can screen out everything but Fox or whatever. I don't know what the solution is for that. I think recognizing it, I think talking about it isn't a terrible thing, but the people who need to hear it aren't the ones listening to you. They're listening to Fox. So I think that's troublesome, and it's partly a function of algorithms, and it's partly a function of human nature. From the money perspective, it's dire. There's a local newspaper here that, is actually not terrible. And the editor was at the San Francisco Examiner for years, and, is just really a great guy. But they're hanging on by their toenails from a financial standpoint. I see that I have, a lot of friends who are still in mainstream journalism of one sort or another. And, the technology world, which I wrote for, always kind of does okay because those magazines attract advertisers who kind of have to advertise there if you're, it's just sort of a given. And so that world seems to be kind of holding together somewhat. But the other, there are a lot fewer staff writers, and so it's all freelance, and you don't have any insurance or anything, and so fewer people go into it. So we're seeing the talent pool shrink on top of everything else. At the same time, I think it's amazing, really. I have a cat situation here. I think that I meet especially some young people who are going into journalism or who have found themselves writing stories and all, who are so smart and so dedicated and really have a way to reach out and be a voice for their generations. And I think that's where the potential lies. I think that I get sort of mad at people my age. I'm 72. I sometimes get mad because when we were kids, we were going to change the world, and it was all, good. And so many people my age now, maybe your guys' age, really just want to be comfortable and don't want to think too hard or not have to do anything. But when I meet people in their 20s and even 30s, I see a lot of people who still have a lot of energy, and they're really, so maybe it will peter out too. But I think that right now they could be voting blocks. They could be people who reach out and convince others. And so I see both good and bad as in everything. But I have hope because of those young people.
Yeah, I had a lot of friends that were journalists in the newspaper trade, and that just has become, it's just dying. The only ones that are surviving are the ones that have been purchased by the big conglomerates that basically, like you were saying, they have a lot of freelancers, don't have a lot of staff, and they outsource all of their things like printing and advertising. And it's just kind of depressing to see that, because I always grew up with a newspaper, and being a journalist back in the day, I had to have the newspaper. I wanted to know what was going on. And now you pick up the newspaper and it's all ads, and there's a lot of fluff pieces and a lot of stuff that's been snagged from some other newspaper. And it's just not a lot of original content out there. And that's kind of sad.
There is, on the plus side, I guess I would also add, though, that, and an interesting note, pretty much any topic that comes to mind for me, I'll be watching something, and I go, wish I knew more about that or something, you know, a quick Google search, and I have the world at my fingertips, and some of it might be slanted, but it's my job to figure out which of those there are. But we've never lived in a time when so much information was available, and that's thrilling, you know. I get lost every day, you know, in one search or another, and reading up on things. And, you know, maybe that will outweigh the algorithmic inequities, or, you know, as we move forward.
I think part of the problem is the lack of an authoritative source for, like, truth and news and journalism now, and the real lack of trust that people have. But, you know, speaking of local journalism and the problems that news organizations are having here, like surviving, there's a couple of things. One is here in Texas, there's an organization called Texas Tribune that was organized as a nonprofit some time ago and has done a great job of reporting on Texas news over the years, and they've had partnerships like with the New York Times and other organizations. And they're totally a nonprofit, and they've been a very successful nonprofit. They've done really well. So that nonprofit, the idea of organizing as a nonprofit to do journalism seems like a viable thing, and I know there are other nonprofits now that are doing well with that. The other thing is that here at the University of Texas, there's an annual event called the International Symposium on Online Journalism. And Scoob and I have been to that before. I've been going to that for several years. You know, the people who show up for that are people who are looking for solutions to the problems of journalism now. And doing innovative stuff with digital journalism. And they're trying to find their way to, you know, find paths to ways to organize, to present news that can succeed, and also solving the problems like the local news problem, which is, you know, an acknowledged and huge problem. So I guess I feel kind of hopeful because I've seen signs of hopeful things in, you know, things like the Texas Tribune and the kinds of things that people bring to the symposium. There's still a lot of people who are interested in reporting and doing it well.
It's true. I should have mentioned when I was talking about all these young people that I've met, a good number of them are with groups like Montana Free Press, and it must sound somewhat similar where you know, very dedicated and very strict about the truth. And, you know, it gives it a local slant. And there are some, I've noticed more and more, there are individuals who regularly on even just Facebook or Twitter or, you know, especially Reddit, who really make it their job to try and sort through and sort of bring to the surface some of the most important points about things. And so we're getting things in ways that aren't as official or as authoritative, but that are actually more timely often, and that can kind of be compared to others that are coming up at the same time. And so, yeah, I see hope. I don't despair.
Yeah, talk about despair. I despair when I turn on the AM radio. That used to be the source of local news. That's where the local stations were. That's where I started working, in the little town in West Texas where John and I both grew up. And you go to the AM radio dial now, and there's no local news. It's all coming in from the mothership in L.A. or New York or Chicago, wherever the big networks that have basically purchased all of these stations, so there's no longer a local voice on the local radio station. It's just
getting local are the ads.
it's just crazy, but it's just sad that the local news is an endangered species now.
Well, yeah. I would guess that in the next 10 years, we'll see some changes that we can't even guess now, because when I look back 20 years ago, I couldn't have predicted the climate that exists today for information exchange and all. I think if there's ever a way to sort out the chaff, to kind of regularly get the truth out of the, you know, that there's some, that would be really lovely. I don't know whether that can happen. I don't see how it could happen right now, but I am hopeful.
Well, I remember when blogging was more of a thing, kind of when it was fresh and new and a lot of us were doing it, we would say that now you can have all these different perspectives on what's happening in the world. And if you read several blogs and get several perspectives on it, you'll be closer to the truth. We were so incredibly stupid. I just can't believe that we thought that. And, you know, what we really find is that having so many channels available and so many of them being social rather than professional, you know, networks of news, that it's just created a kind of chaotic environment. And the fact that we aren't all getting our news from the same few sources, the real result of that is that there's been this huge division. You know, people have such different belief systems. And of course, they all think that what they believe is true. But I don't know. Maybe there is no truth. Rudy Giuliani said truth isn't truth. So,
you know, my mom was a huge fan of Dan Rather. She just loved Dan Rather. And I even managed to get her a personalized signed photo and everything. It's hanging right near me right now. And
yeah, he lives right here in Austin now.
Well, I am a huge fan. And so you have these individual voices, you know, that continue to be sane. And, you know, if you follow him, perhaps you probably do if he's there. But, you know, so pretty much every day there's a little gem. He like throws out something that's really smart and not incendiary, but not chickening out, you know, and really saying very, very real things. And it may be, in the end, it's a choir of those voices that there become better ways of aggregating that, you know, if that, again, though, the issue becomes those people who want to narrow their sources to one or two that only support their own biases. And I don't, that's going to mess with our elections, if nothing else, for years. And I don't have a solution for that.
Yeah, Dan Rather was my first big media hero when I was getting started in radio. You know, he was a Texas radio reporter before he got the big time. And then later on, watching him on the floor of the Democratic convention being punched out by Mayor Daley's goons, and he was able to recover from that and continue reporting, you know, that's what heroes are made of. So that's why I followed him for a long time.
Exactly. You know, as long as we're talking about despair, one of the things that really concerns me is when I was in high school for 2 years running, I had an hour a day of social studies, you know, and civics. And kids don't have that now. They don't have that perspective. You know, we're taught that our country stands for liberty and justice for all and all these phrasings that shaped me and I think a lot of other people and that informed choices that I made. And these kids now just don't have either the basic civics, kind of how does it work, or the history that goes, you know, with it. And that might be one place that some effort could actually help to make a change.
Yeah, in high school, we had a class that was required called government. And it actually talked about how the government was organized. You know, unfortunately, there was a lot of skewed information in there. You didn't hear a lot about how the government functioned during certain periods, like, you know, when the Ku Klux Klan was running a lot of governments in the South. You didn't hear anything about that. And that's now become a no-no. You can't talk about civics and the civil rights and current affairs in Texas schools because the legislature said you can't do that. So that's
critical race theory.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't think the legislature... They didn't exactly say what people thought they said, apparently. My understanding was that at least where some of this stuff was concerned, like where there was some talk about people believed that they were no longer going to be able to mention the Ku Klux Klan or whatever, but that wasn't really what was happening there. They were relegating that. It was like people were trying to bring that into a different realm, but it belongs in what they call the TEKS here, the basic knowledge skills that they teach in Texas. They have a curriculum that's based on that. And someone had been arguing, you know, this stuff belongs in that pile of information. It belongs in the curriculum. And people were trying to like bring it into legislation and that sort of thing. So it's a little bit confusing right now. I couldn't tell you for sure what people are allowed to teach or not teach in Texas. But we know that has an influence. Texas has always had an influence on the rest of the country. A lot of textbooks are, I guess, field tested here or whatever. There seems to be a big impact on education from what happens here. And I would hate to think that...
It's a center for textbooks, among other things.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And of course, considering that we have such a right-wing government right now, they are certainly coming down on this critical race theory idea.
I think it was a poor choice of words to name it that.
Well, I mean, it was an academic thing. It was something that was happening at higher levels of academia. Nobody envisioned teaching it in elementary school. So I think there's a lot of confusion about that, too.
Sure. Yeah, I feel for kids right now, like especially like teenage kids who are just coming into their own and, you know, climate mayhem and COVID and... extreme right wing mechanisms. And so, you know, I think any effort given, we really try to support the youth here. And we feel it's incredibly important that they feel like they have a voice and that they have opportunities to, you know, again, we have that emphasis on social justice. So we manage to kind of pull kids in on projects and all. It's going to be an interesting next 10 or 20 years. Things are accelerating at such a pace on all fronts. And so I don't feel like I'm in any position to predict, but I'm in for the ride.
No, I do wonder what the next generation or the generation that's just emerging right now is going to be like. I hate to do that kind of generational thinking and try to make up some monolithic characterization of Generation X or Y or Z. But I do think that, you know, their survival is at stake. And we're really screwing things. Our generation and maybe the generation immediately following, we're really screwing things up, you know?
Yep.
And my hope, and I have no sense of this, but my hope is that they realize that we're screwing things up and that they're going to focus really hard on fixing it and not just throw up their hands, you know?
Right. Well, yeah. Again, I feel like maybe I'm meeting a unique subset of the younger generation, but I've been quite impressed lately. You know, knowledge base, you know, really working hard to inform themselves and having, you know, pretty well thought out ideas. And, you know, so a lot of them are artists or musicians or, you know, not too many are going into government yet or anything quite like that. But it's hopeful. And I think that it's partly that human nature would like to be better. One of the things in South Africa that was very interesting, we went to a animal park. You don't pay to go. You just drive across a cattle guard and you're suddenly in the oldest animal preserve in all of Africa. It's crazy. You know, it's just truly living right with them. And but deep in one of them, there was a little rest spot. And in that area, they, some years before, during the period of reconciliation in South Africa, had brought all these religious leaders from around the world together to try and figure out what was core, what was at the spiritual base for all of these disparate disciplines. And they boiled it down to four words, which I thought was pretty impressive. Be good, do good. And, you know, you have to agree on good for it to work out, I guess. But I feel like that's kind of a good mantra, and one where every day it helps me refine my own, you know, crazy thinking.
Maybe we'll make that our motto at the Plutopia News Network.
There you go. It's a good one, huh?
Yeah. I mean, we try to do that. I don't know. What I do know is I know people who are doing things that I think are terrible and they think that they're doing good. So part of how that works is knowing what's good, knowing whether you're doing good or not.
What was the old...
Constantly reassessing, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was the old saying, beauty is in the eye of the beholder? Maybe good is the same way. It depends on what you consider good.
Well, I knew people like who were very dedicated Christians and really trying to do good as Christians, yet they were also very devoted in their support for Donald Trump. And what they said was, well, yeah, we support him because he does some bad things, we think, but he's going to protect us. And, you know... I mean, even if you think he's going to protect you, sort of ignoring the difficulties about that guy, I just couldn't quite, you know, figure it out. I mean, how do you convince people like that that, if nothing else, they shouldn't be voting for the guy?
It's just curious to me how Christianity and racism have become such parallel tracks, and that there are so many, you know, who profess to be followers of this fellow who may or may not have existed, Jesus, you know, I mean, it's all, but they don't follow the teachings that came with that, you know. Just so many, it's curious to me how, again, going back to that idea that logic isn't always at the core, because, you know, love thy neighbor is not the same as shoot the guy, you know, with your unregistered gun that, you know, it's like that you have a right to do these horrible things. It doesn't give me much hope from a religious standpoint. I think that's different from spiritual and, you know, but religious, as soon as it starts to aggregate around a body of thought or a person or something, it seems to devolve to some point in my experience.
Yeah, and there's a level of hypocrisy in all that.
Yeah, I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church, and when I was a little kid, that was, you know, it was a fairly normal church. And about the 1970s, it suddenly became a wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican Party, the right wing of the Republican Party.
Yep.
And it's only recently that they finally realized that they really were headed in the wrong direction. I think they have had a few house cleanings there and their leadership. But
interesting.
That was always just a very strange change, because it was really just, you know, they taught the Bible and the gospel and all that. But all of a sudden, it became way more political. Suddenly, you were hearing about the evil Democrats, and they were telling us how the Catholics were stocking guns in their basement because they wanted to get John F. Kennedy in the presidency. And they nearly lost their minds when he was elected. So the religion has been perverted by a lot of these political parties.
Right. Yeah, it's a dilemma, because that's where our moral base could be coming from. So we have to look elsewhere these days. I mean, there's hope. I mean, I think there are some churches that are reevaluating and reassessing and being honest with themselves, but I don't see that as the major movement within those worlds.
Yeah, it's kind of hard for me to say. You know, I don't go to a particular church or really spend a lot of time talking with people who are particularly religious. And I see these things like in the news. I mean, I get a sense of what some of the really right-wing Christians are talking about. But I don't know whether that's widespread within religion. I tend to think it's... You know, I think in general, this sort of like very far right thing that's going on that seems so pervasive is not pervasive at all, that it's just a few people who are really loud about it, and that it's, you know, the volume is turned up and all the media sources, right or left, are amplifying it.
I get that, but when I look at the actual election results, there are a lot of people who are buying into, you know, especially some of the smaller elections and all, where you can really see that there are individuals running who are really just puppets for one or another extreme right-wing mindset, and that they get elected, you know, that more than half of the people, or at least whatever it took to be the majority in there. That's troubling, you know. It's like, I can understand 10% of the people. I can maybe even understand 25% of the people. But for it to be half of the people is terrifying on certain mornings.
Well, supposedly only around 25% of the voters in this country are Republicans. But Republicans are winning elections pretty well. Now, in Texas, gerrymandering has an influence on that, as I said earlier. But we still have Republicans winning statewide races. And, you know, it's not that Republicans are necessarily horrible, but it's right. That they've sort of been hijacked by some people who are necessarily horrible. And they're starting to, I think part of it was the influence of Donald Trump and his sort of philosophy of cruelty. And we see that here. We see Governor Abbott in Texas trying really hard to appear as cruel as Donald Trump was, because he thinks that'll help him win the primary. You know, I don't know what to think about that. You know, because
when is your next election?
Huh?
When is the next election?
Well, the primary is next March, I think, and then the election is the following November 2022.
Gotcha.
And the gubernatorial race will be in 2022. And Abbott, you know, certainly has right to be concerned about that. He's already on the ropes a bit. He nearly destroyed the state in February. Actions of the Republicans affected our power grid in such a way that we had a very bad experience last February. I'm sure you heard about that.
It was national news.
yeah, exactly. And he didn't handle that very well. So,
Yeah, he claimed that they fixed it in the most recent legislative session, but they really didn't fix it. They just moved some stuff around and made a few pronouncements, but the real situation has not been fixed. And the big problem in Texas is big money, big oil, big gas, big corporate money that is coming into politics. That's where the real power is.
Sure.
Well, the problem with the electrical grid was a combination of deregulation and the fact that we had separated ourselves from the two major power grids that serve all the rest of the United States, which, among other things, have weatherization requirements that are federal requirements. We separated from that because we didn't want to have to respect the federal requirements. Why should we have to weatherize? It's never going to get that cold in Texas. Well, it got that cold.
Yeah, I think the next few years, I mean, there's no reason to believe that climate will return to any kind of former normalcy in the future, you know, in any kind of near future. And so it will test a lot of these systems and a lot of the, you know, all these people who are so noisy about states' rights and all, you know, are the same people who, for some reason, don't think rich people should pay taxes. I mean, that to me is so confusing. It's like, I can understand super rich people wanting to be Republicans and, you know, enact laws that suit their pocketbooks. I'm confused by the vast number of people who support that way of thinking when all it does is make it harder on them, both because infrastructure isn't paid for and their own taxes are higher. So, you know, it's like crazy.
It's also odd to see the states' rights people decide that mayors shouldn't be able to make public health decisions for their cities.
Well, so we have that in Montana. So Jim Forte said no mandates, no mask mandates would be allowed. And so the state is in a kind of schizophrenic mode where, like in Butte, people are pretty good about the masks and all again, and we're all vaccinated, and, you know, like that's all a good thing. And then there's the rest of the state where they aren't allowed to wear a mask, you know, like kids in schools or whatever. And
oh, my Lord.
That's just, you know, it doesn't take, you don't have to be very smart to see the facts in this, but it doesn't seem to be tied to smart. It's frightening how many smart people there are who are misreading, choosing to misread.
Not everybody's smart about everything, I guess. Or not anybody's smart about everything.
Well, yeah, there's that.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how we ended up with Tucker Carlson being elected to oversee all of our governments. That seems to be what has happened. Yeah, if he says it, then, oh, well, we better do that.
And he so transparently lies, you know, and so he can be caught in them, but nobody cares, you know. It doesn't matter that he said this or that, that turns out to be, you know, a bald-faced lie. But, you know, it somehow fits within the political paradigm, so okay. Crazy.
Well, we've reached the end of our hour, so hopefully you'll come back sometime and we'll decide how to solve all of these problems that we've been articulating today.
Yeah, we all have homework now, so we have to figure that out.
Exactly. Thanks so much for joining us, though.
It was fun. Nice to see you guys. Take care.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.